tell you what, Warren, New York City, life is a struggle, baby. We're going to get him.
That was
Slater. That's right, Daddy. Shut up. Slater, you're a marked man. Valentine, you're marked. Hubba Dink and One Man Gang. Listen at me. Slater, you got that TV title. It don't belong to you. It belongs to the people.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 148 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson. And as this funky music playing underneath me right now could only indicate, going back to the early 80s for Jim Crockett Promotions, where they seem to have a lot of funky tunes for their shows. Even worldwide, up to 86, had like that disco-y theme, which, you could really get down to that one, as Vince McMahon would say. Anyway, this is Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling from February 26, 1983. After I had picked out this show, I remembered, oddly, that was the weekend that my grandmother passed away. I mean, she was 83 years old at the time, but I remember, you know, what she looked like and her being around. Anyway, she was big into, like, Democratic Party politics, within the city, mostly, and was on the Democratic City Committee, but was apparently important enough that we received a call at the house from Governor Mike Dukakis, and I answered the phone at the age of, well, not quite four. Not sure. It really doesn't sound like something I would have done at that age, but I was told that by multiple sources that that actually happened. So here we are. But yes, Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, 1983. I went back and I was like, boy, it's been a long time since I've done a 1983 show. Yeah, episode 80. So it's been 68 episodes, over a year, since I've done this very crucial year in wrestling history. In fact, it might even be the best year, because you still have all the territories pretty much running strong. Yeah, it's not the greatest WWF year in the world, but, you know, there's some interesting things going on with everything nearing the end for Backlund and them trying to stretch that out, and Vince formally taking power once the sale closes in the middle of the year and leaving the NWA. But anyway, I'm going to put all that aside. Before I get into everything else, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Facebook.com/GreetingsFromAllentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And do check out the other shows on the Pro Wrestling Only. I mean, you know what they are. I've said it week after week. So do give that a subscription and a 5-star review on iTunes if you would. Now, I've been talking about being more cognizant about my diet and my recent heartburn problems. Well, I've gotten a little bit more clarity on that in the last couple of weeks, because I did, well, in the last couple of days, actually, as I went to the doctor this past Thursday, where I pretty much got put through a gauntlet, where a 20-minute appointment turned into a 2-hour and 20-minute appointment, and as a consequence, I had to miss the company holiday party, which was bowling at this place called King's in Dedham, Massachusetts. But in any event, so I had to do a couple of ultrasounds. They did, you know, the usual blood work that they always do. And I'd never done an ultrasound before because, well, I can't get pregnant. At least I don't think so. I mean, that would be really weird. I would end up on the cover of the National Enquirer, the Weekly World News, if that still existed. In any event, so two different things were going on, one of which was, all right, do I actually have heartburn, acid reflux? Well, instead, they referred back to my emergency room visit, which I described back, it was like episode 82, where I went to the ER on the Sunday of Labor Day weekend in 2018. And as I went through that whole process, and I was in there for probably about 6-7 hours, a CAT scan and all this other stuff, There was never really any clarity given to me on what exactly was wrong with me, and for the longest time, I assumed that I had food poisoning from something that I had eaten that day, which would have been a hoagie cheesesteak and a like a small junior bacon cheeseburger or something to that effect from Wendy's. So I'd blame that for the longest time. This recent thing was something that was very similar in nature, but not as acute. And I had no idea what it was. So I made the doctor's appointment, and after doing an ultrasound, at least that ultrasound, they diagnosed me with gallstones. And I thought, oh, great. They're like, oh, yeah, there's a one stone that's 20 millimeters by 10 millimeters in you. And there are other ones, too. I'm like, wait a minute. No, there's no way. It has to be at least 4 inches by 5 inches, because the pain that I feel, it's probably it can't possibly be that small. But it is. And when you have gallstones, what generally happens is they take out your gallbladder. But that's not going to be for a little while. So I actually do, in a little bit of self-fulfilling prophecy, I really do have to think about what I eat, which means no fatty foods. I'm retired for at least the short term. I guess semi-retire. This was what semi-retirement means. I wondered that last week when it came to Wayne Bloom. But no more bacon, no more pizza, no more fried chicken, no more cheesesteaks. I mean, the cheesesteak industry around here is going to be in mourning with the fact that I just can't eat that for a while, because apparently can't digest it. And if you can't digest it, well, you know what happens. You end up on the toilet, and then you end up with these little gallstone attacks, which really, really sucks. The other thing I had to go in for, is this weird little growth on the side of my face, which completely sucks because they're making me do that first before they take care of my gallstones, which is way more painful because I have no pain on the thing on the side of my face. So now I end up with all these doctor visits in a row around the time of Christmas and New Year's, with my insurance changing on January 1. It's really just wonderful. But I guess the idea is, if you have insurance, make sure you get yourself checked out on a regular basis. And I'm going to do the more you know for that, because it seems to be plainly obvious. But I've been eating a lot of saltines lately, and basically all this sort of plain food. I just made a batch of chicken wings today as I taped this. It's before Christmas. I know this will be coming out after, but made chicken wings for my wife. I can't eat any of them. I mean, I could eat one or two, but I'm just choosing not to eat anything that might be fatty. I mean, it's certainly not the fattiest. I can eat chicken, and I guess I could have had one or two, but I'm really trying to refrain from eating as much, and maybe I'll end up losing weight out of this deal. Who knows? So in any event, why this show? It is not available on the WWE Network. When they uploaded all those Mid-Atlantic shows from 81 through 86, there's some gaps in there, particularly in February of 83. The last one that's there is February 12th, and then it doesn't start up again until March the 12th. So there are three shows missing, and this happens to be one of them. But just like with the Raw last week, don't tell anybody about it. So they're building to a early version of the Super Show for JCP, Final Conflict, which was held in Greensboro on March the 12th. It was not available on closed circuit. I had originally thought that it was, but it obviously they're years away from pay-per-view, and there was apparently a legendary traffic jam trying to get to Greensboro with thousands turned away at the door. And this goes into Jim Crockett Promotions being in a real position of strength for being one of the strongest territories, even in 1983, when there are a lot of them at that point. Only a few of them had gone under, like Los Angeles was gone and the WWF had moved in. But JCP was kind of ascendant, in part because you got Ric Flair, who is the world champion at this point in time. He'll lose it and then get it back at Starrcade, which was the entire idea. And when you have the world champion in the territory, they understood, okay, we're operating from a position of great strength. So the supercard concept is coming along. They probably missed the boat on not doing closed circuit for that show, just because, you know, the whole traffic thing. I mean, people wanted to see this because they are building up the main event, which was not Ric Flair versus Greg Valentine for the world title, Valentine being the United States champion, but Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood challenging the tag team champions being Sergeant Slaughter and Don Kernodle. I always thought it was Kernoodle for the longest time, but now I've watched enough TV that's how they say it, so I'm just going to go along with it. So the territory is doing pretty well. You got a lot of familiar faces, which is something that I always stress when, you know, a lot of guys that you see later in the WWF, including one who is harassing Sergeant Slaughter at this point in time. We're going to see him on this show. I'm not going to say who it is, but it is somebody in a previous incarnation who turns up in the WWF later in the decade, let's say. So what do we have on this missing show from the network? Well, we got Greg Valentine, who, as U.S. champion, is the number one contender for Ric Flair's World Heavyweight title, which is kind of an interesting thing because Valentine, a classic heel, and Ric Flair, well, I'll get into what his whole thing is, because there's actually going to be a joint promo of Valentine and Flair as they talk about some upcoming matches that they are having. We do see the tag team champions, Sergeant Slaughter and Don Kernodle. I'm going to have problems with this the entire show, so I'm just going to have to, you know, say, I'm sorry that Don Kernodle, I just can't say your name properly. Maybe you should have had a longer WWF run, because the guys who do, I never seem to have as much of a problem with. We also get matches with Jack Briscoe, who I think has never been on Greetings from Allentown in the past, because I generally haven't done shows from his era. I mean, in the 70s when he was NWA champion. Sweet Brown Sugar. And then we got Dick Slater, the new television champion, who is challenged by Mike Rotundo. That's a whole angle we're going to see coming up later on the show. And then one more thing, this is JCP. You're never going to guess what's happening with Jimmy Valiant at this point in time. I'm just going to leave you in suspense on that one. So with that in mind, why don't we just get right to it for Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling for February 26, 1983. I have a story about that song by Adam Ant, Goody Two Shoes, which was number 12 that week in 1983. So I had downloaded the song by Dead or Alive, You Spin Me Right Round. This is years ago, and I actually downloaded it through iTunes, 100% legal, above board, all that stuff. Then all of a sudden, a year or two later, when I clicked on the song in iTunes, all of a sudden it started playing Goody Two Shoes by Adam Ant, and I could not figure out what the hell had happened. It had basically taken the song that I purchased and turned it into something else. It played the correct song originally for like a year or two, and then all of a sudden it changed. Now, you'd probably say, well, Pete, you probably linked it to a different file. I never downloaded Goody Two Shoes by Adam Ant, so I have no idea how it ever got into my iTunes. And I'm wondering if this ever happened to anybody else. It's just one of those weird things. Like when I could not get rid of the BS Report Bill Simmons smiling avatar out of my cell phone from like 5 or 6 years ago. It was like he invaded my cell phone to talk about Tom Brady and the 2008 Boston Celtics. Anyway, our first match, and it goes right into it. Like, they go, it's a pretty much joint in progress. It's the United States champion, Greg Valentine, taking on Vinny Valentino, which I don't really have much other than that he wrestled from 80 to 89. So he must have really loved 1980s wrestling. Got into it right at the beginning and then got out of it right at the end. And these two dudes, I don't know why it came to mind right away. If Valentine and Valentino went to school together and they sat everybody by alphabetical order, Valentine would be sitting in front of Valentino in every single class, because it's pretty much impossible, unless there's a Valentini, which I've never heard that name. It's kind of like my friendship with Johnny Wong in high school. Like, yes, we're together in all these classes, and he's right behind me in just about every spot. So, like I said, we get joined in progress because they knew enough to let Valentine get warmed up. The 10, 15 minutes probably wasn't that long. So you get a top wrist lock right off the get-go. And as I said, Valentine, number one contender, U.S. champ. And it most of 83, he was the United States champion. Of course, at Starrcade, he has the dog collar match against Roddy Piper, which was non-title, by the way. That should not go unsaid. Doesn't take anything away from the match because it was more of a blood feud. It meant more than the title itself. Valentine held the U.S. title cumulatively 509 days between multiple title reigns, but this particular one makes up most of that. And he works the arm. And the referee's shirt, I don't know who the official is here, but I got very confused because I thought he wasn't wearing a shirt because the color of it is exactly the same as his skin color. It's not really the greatest look, but luckily he has rings, I think, at the end of the short sleeves on his arm. Bob Caudle, who is our host for Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, as per usual. This was taped only 2 days, or 3 days before, on February 23rd. And Caudle lets us know that, in the words of Bruce Springsteen, the biggest man you've ever seen is coming to town.
And let me remind you, too, that in the very near future, right here, you'll be seeing the eighth wonder of the world, Andre the Giant. As we really look forward to seeing Andre back.
When I just think of various wrestlers' careers objectively, not considering, you know, Andre being this huge guy and him being the attraction because of his size, I would love to have his career where you just float into all these various territories, you help out the local babyface, you help him, you know, win the feud or whatever, and then you're on your way. Like, that's a really cool role to have, but that's pretty much wrapping up in 83 and into 84. By the time 85 rolls around, Andre is exclusive to the WWF. With occasional stuff in Japan and Mexico, which I think Andre was only allowed because of who he was, and he kind of gets grandfathered in, unlike anybody else, because of, I guess, the relationship he might have had with Vince at that point. So Andre comes in to Crockett in April, and he's helping out Jimmy Valiant and Bugsy McGraw. More on them a little bit later on. Valentine with an inverted atomic drop. Now he starts working the leg, as you might expect, and it scores later with a back suplex, letting All Japan Pro Wrestling know that, well, I don't come over to Japan very often, but if you want to give me a look-see, that's fine. He only worked New Japan very briefly, at least according to Cage Match. Spinning toe hold, and then he does another one, but into the figure four leg lock. And that is how Valentine picks up the victory. Which is funny, because you hear Bob Caudle calling the entire match by himself. I'm like, okay, so he's the only one there. That's fine. But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Dick Slater weighs in on everything as a color guy who just doesn't talk the entire time. Who does he think he is? Bruno Sammartino on Superstars in 87? I say that because Bruno's the only guy that I will let get away with saying absolutely nothing during the course of a broadcast. It also reminds me of the time in high school where I was broadcasting high school basketball, and my usual partner, he was off somewhere else. I don't know where the hell he was. So they paired me with this kid who was a sophomore, who I think was just legitimately terrified to say anything. So at halftime, I just said, yeah, look, if you want to go hang out with your friends over on the opposite bleachers, that's fine. I'll take this thing home by myself. So that's what he did. And I think that was the end of his broadcasting career. So yeah, Slater just weighs in on Valentine. We immediately go to the promo area in the studio in Raleigh, I believe. This is where this is taped, one of the television stations there. I kind of went over that in the Mid-Atlantic show I did from 1981, a long time ago. I think it was episode 71. Do check that out in the archives. So Dick Slater is the new television champion. Apparently he's got some sort of bond with the U.S. champion, Valentine.
Well, I may put it this way. Mike Rotundo is going to say he slipped on a banana peel. But Mike Rotundo, you're a good kid in professional wrestling, but you're just a kid. You don't have the experience that Dick Slater have, and you don't have the savvy and the viciousness that I have when I get in the ring. That's what it takes to be a true professional and a true champion. Greg Valentine, the U.S. heavyweight champion, he didn't get that belt because he got in the ring and played around. When he gets in the ring, he means business. And same with Dick Slater. When I get in the ring, I give 100%, and like I said before, I do not have to cheat like a lot of people say I do. I don't smoke, and I don't drink, and I am the athlete that every man, every woman, every person out there on TV land with the TV heavyweight champion looks at and admires day by day, minute by minute, every time you turn the television on. If you saw Dick Slater, what joy what feeling, what gratitude you'd have all during your day.
It is such a stretch of credulity that Dick Slater would say, oh, I don't drink. Here's a guy who got into barroom brawls as a professional wrestler. I don't think he was there because he enjoyed the cranberry juice, is what I'm saying. I mean, that's far-fetched even for a professional wrestling promo in the 1980s, okay? So Greg Valentine, he saunters in, he congratulates Slater on winning the television title off Mike Rotundo, because as we know, Valentine always has issues with Mike Rotundo, whether it's here in Mid-Atlantic, whether it's 85 WWF and it's the Dream Team and the US Express, if it's SummerSlam 91 with its IRS versus Valentine, or even if it's the November 16th, 1991 edition of Superstars, which, by the way, I covered back in episode 19. Check that out in the archives.
There's a mean, vicious person. He's been around a long time. He knows what he's doing in that ring. That's exactly why he made Mike Rotundo give that belt up. I know Rotundo's going around saying, telling everybody that this man stole that title from him, but that's all false. Just like you got Roddy Piper, Ricky Steamboat, Wahoo McDaniel, Blackjack Mulligan, the list goes on of past U.S. heavyweight champions, Bob Cuddle. But I am the greatest of all.
Valentine's case as the greatest United States champion of all time is actually pretty strong, although that there are other big names who have held that belt, which he goes into. But I'm just talking about when they actually held the title belt themselves. He has a similar claim for the Intercontinental title for his reign from 84 into the summer of 85. I think it kind of pales in comparison to, say, a Randy Savage. But Valentine was up there because that was really when the title meant something. Now, here comes Mike Rotundo out onto the set looking like the love child of Joey Morella and Joaquin Phoenix. That was just my first impression. So he wants a rematch with Dick Slater. And by the way, the way that he's dressed is very interesting, too. He looks like he should be hanging out with Tony Manero Saturday Night Fever. I mean, it is 1983, but, you know, that movie is now 5.5 years in the rearview mirror at this point. I have to put out that screenshot because you don't think of Mike Rotundo as somebody who is going to go out to, like, a dance party. It's like Ed McMahon's dance machine from Saturday Night Live from back in the day. Mike Rotundo's dance party. That would be an interesting thing, but as Slater said, Rotundo's just a kid. He's just a kid catching flies in his mouth. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. That's his kid.
Misty's about to fall.
Oh, save that pie for later, hon.
Ryan, don't need towels.
Anything I can do?
Mom, put on some coffee.
Be easy now, Misty.
It's going to be a long night. Welcome to the war, young fella. The Red Man Reaction. Satisfaction.
Yes, this video has original 1983 commercials, and I'm very excited about that. I'll probably play one of them from each ad break rather than go through all of them. Amco, I mean, I think I've covered that in the past. There's one for a pizza crust. Just to say that pizza today is way better than what pizza used to be, which is why it's so heartbreaking that I have to lay off the stuff for a while. But that commercial for Red Man chewing tobacco, first of all, it's a chewing tobacco ad on television, which struck me as strange. I don't know if those or when those got banned. I'm sure that there was a period of time. But it's like this heartfelt ad, like, you gotta come out to the barn. The the mare is foaling the horse. And like, oh, put on a coffee. And then you got Terry Taylor as the Red Rooster making an appearance in the middle of the commercial. I mean, that just absolutely has everything. So up next, we have Sergeant Slaughter and Don Kernodle, the World Tag Team Champions, taking on Frank Monty and Dizzy Hogan. Yes, Brutus Beefcake in his earlier incarnation, where he was making sure that nobody was mistaken about the fact that he was close with Hulk Hogan. That they were friends, or perhaps brothers, if you will. There's nothing more brotherly than being a brother of Hulk Hogan. Because, well, I mean, for the obvious reasons. A little bit of an early 1983 run for Dizzy Hogan in Jim Crockett Promotions. He does turn up on the Super Sunday show in the AWA in April of 83. But here in JCP, he got scouted by Gary Hart on the episode 2 weeks before this, as he was working in an enhancement match, and Gary Hart was kind of raving about him, and I'm not entirely sure where that led. Probably nowhere, but hey. Slaughter starts this one with Frank Monty, and Monty gets the advantage as Slaughter is taken down, and then Kernodle is tagged in, but he gets arm-dragged as well. Dizzy Hogan gets in there and starts working the arm. And now with Slaughter in there, he gets arm-dragged, but then he fights back, connects with a knee to the gut of Dizzy Hogan, but then misses an elbow, and Monty tags back in for Dizzy Hogan, and Kernodle gets arm-dragged. And I'm just thinking, what the hell is Frank Monty getting so much offense in this match for? It seems pretty straightforward that you have the tag team champions on one side. You have Dizzy Hogan and this guy Frank Monty on the other side. Like, okay, maybe Dizzy Hogan will get a little bit of shine since, you know, they said nice things about him on the TV. A mild push. And Frank Monty's going to get his ass kicked. But instead, he's arm-dragging the champs all over the place. It's a little strange, I think. But finally, they gain a measure of control. But Dizzy Hogan is the one who ends up in peril as Bob Caudle promises some workout footage of Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood. And there's nothing I love more than two guys working out. I mean, more on that a little bit later. A backbreaker by Sergeant Slaughter. And he does the two times one where he holds him up and then drops him on his knee a second time. That only gets a two count. The champs do cut off the ring, and Slaughter scores with a vertical suplex on Dizzy Hogan. And I thought to myself, just seeing those two guys together, here are two WrestleMania main eventers at various times. Yeah, was the Beefcake Hogan versus Money Inc. the actual main event of WrestleMania 9? No, but it was presented as a double main event, and Slaughter, of course, closed WrestleMania 7 against Hulk Hogan. But then Dizzy crawls through the legs to then tag Frank Monty. Big mistake there, because Frank Monty's offense is not sustainable. It's kind of like that year that the Arizona Cardinals started out 4-1, and they got lucky in a lot of games, and then they ended the season losing their last 11, and their coach got fired. That's Frank Monty in this match. He is the 2012 Arizona Cardinals. He does get in a little bit of offense, but then gets hit with a stun gun on the top rope. But that only gets a two count, which I found amusing. But yeah, let's let Slaughter and Kernodle get in a little bit more offense. Big clothesline by Slaughter. And then Kernodle, once he gets in there, he does a clothesline, but off the second rope. And the pinfall, Dizzy Hogan runs in to break it up. And eventually now Slaughter gets in and is like, enough of this crap. Locks in the Cobra Clutch. And that mercifully ends this match. But it's funny how Dizzy Hogan does not run in for the save when he's locked in the Cobra Clutch. Yes, I know there's this informal rule of you're only allowed one save in a tag match, but wouldn't it make sense to save your partner from that hold that nobody can seem to get out of, even if it would result in a disqualification? I mean, let's think of it from a kayfabe perspective here. He comes in, saves him from the Cobra Clutch. Yes, they lose the match, but they would have lost the match just from him standing on the apron. Instead, his partner is going to get, you know, taken out by this hold, basically put to sleep. I don't know. It makes sense to me. Or, I mean, I would think that you would want to save the guy from harm, even if it results in losing the match by DQ. I just wish that Slaughter and Kernodle had been a little bit more impressive at this point. But maybe they were off their game because of the way the cage match at Final Conflict and the fact that that was going to happen was sprung on them, the way it was presented on TV. They were very angry. They figured that they were done with Steamboat and Youngblood, and they're told, oh no, you're going to have to defend against them in Greensboro, and it's going to be in a cage, and you're not allowed to defend the title between now and then. That was from the February 12th TV. So they had planned a vacation, Slaughter and Kernodle, and they protested this and said, nope, you're not going to be on vacation. You're going to be in Greensboro on that night. But yeah, I do wish that they were a little bit more impressive. But that's not all for this match. As they're in the ring, they get attacked by the man who has been harassing Sergeant Slaughter for several weeks because of how he had been mistreated, and that is something that I covered back in episode 71. Mr. Private Jim Nelson is here to take the fight to Sergeant Slaughter and Don Kernodle.
Here comes Jim Nelson in.
He's on the top rope, and he's going to get slaughtered from behind. And here's Nelson now with a headbutt on Knievel. Jim Nelson, who once was the private of Sergeant Slaughter, Jim Nelson, who a couple of weeks ago came out and admitted that he had been giving some of the secrets of Slaughter and Knievel away, came in and got Slaughter from behind.
I'm not sure what the nature of those secrets are, whether they're in the ring, like, oh, he likes to do a clothesline if you duck an Irish whip the first time, like that kind of scouting, or like he has a fondness for people, for women from like a certain Southeast Asian country. Who knows exactly what it is, but I think the phrase is the chickens are coming home to roost for Sergeant Slaughter, because if you bully somebody and then they rise up in some way, they will come back and bite you at somewhere down the road. So Slaughter himself, you know, in reacting to all of this, he's as if he's flustered enough by the Steamboat and Youngblood thing coming up. Now he's got Private Jim Nelson coming in and taking it to him as well.
Hey, where's Sandy Scott? Quite a promotion. I thought you said Youngblood and Steamboat were supposed to attack us or wrestle us to the 12th of March in Greensboro.
It was Nelson. It wasn't Youngblood and Steamboat. It was Nelson.
Nelson.
Call the private, Nelson.
Nelson.
So you got 30 years of The Simpsons in the books now, and you look back at this angle, and it's a person named Nelson, the name of the bully from The Simpsons, who is rising up in Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling against the bully himself. It's one of those nice full circle sort of things, I guess. Up next, we have Sweet Brown Sugar taking on Ricky Harris. Harris later go on to be known as Black Bart. And Sweet Brown Sugar, just learning a little bit more about him. He also went by the name Skip Young in various territories. And when I saw Sweet Brown Sugar on the listing for this episode, I thought, oh, I was unaware that Coco Ware was in JCP at any point in time. Well, what I've come to find out, and this is why I enjoy doing this show so much, is, you know, to educate myself on things like, yes, there were two different Sweet Brown Sugars. There's this one, and then Coco Ware played a heel under that name in Memphis. And apparently, at a certain point, those two guys ended up in the same place at the same time and had exchanged angry words with each other about the use of the name before they realized that ultimately it doesn't mean anything, and they had one thing in common, which was combating systematic racism in pro wrestling, which was not so much as, well, I'm not going to push an African-American or anything. It was more the quota system that definitely existed back in those days where, well, we're only going to have one black guy here or maybe two or something to that effect. So it's more about combating that. This Sweet Brown Sugar, unlike Coco Ware being a heel in Memphis, babyface his entire career, so it's pretty much the Rick Steamboat, Tito Santana model, let's say. Also, according to the Slam obituary, he passed away in December of 2010. Master of the Dropkick, and was also Pro Wrestling Illustrated's Rookie of the Year for 1979, which was the first year of that publication. And Harris controls early, and he was actually in World Class Championship Wrestling in 1982. I remember hearing about Ricky Harris on WorldCast when they were doing their early episodes. This is very punchy, kicky early on, and then pretty much throughout. A backdrop which almost looked like a leapfrog gone wrong. I'm not quite sure how to put that. I should probably make a GIF file of that. Head to the turnbuckle, Harris sends Sweet Brown Sugar in, but it has no effect because, you know, racist stereotypes and all that. And that got me thinking about hard head science. Like, where the hell does all of this come from? But according to a 2008 study, women have thicker skulls than men by a matter of 7.1 millimeters to 6.5 millimeters. I don't know what all of that means or if it's even accurate. I think you probably get sampling bias out of all that. And there are certainly, from what I found researching the issue, some serious selection bias in 19th century studies, at least from what I could gather. I'm not a scientist. I just feel the need should point out that scientific studies before a certain period of time suffer from selection bias. I mean, even somebody like me, I think, can comprehend that. As we get a chin lock by Harris, who is not all that husky. Yes, that's my second Bray Wyatt joke of the show. Brown Sugar actually fights out of it, but then he gets quickly cut off as we get that up and over move in the corner where he gets Irish Whip and then kind of jumps up and over. And he hits, he meaning Sweet Brown Sugar, two of those classic drop kicks, that, and he ends up picking up the win that way. I have to admit, it was a pretty good-looking drop kick. I wouldn't put it quite at that Jim Brunzel level, but still pretty good. And the fact that he had to hit two of them instead of one, well, he should have only had to hit one if it's that good. I think, now that I think about Sweet Brown Sugar, which, by the way, not a name you could give a wrestler now or pretty much in the last 15 or 20 years at minimum. I'm actually trying to cut back on sugar. In fact, I've stopped putting Splenda in my coffee, at least in the short term, because I think it's a good start on the path to losing weight and, you know, just general healthier living.
Now, fans, as we said, something that we think you're really going to be interested in, a workout right here with Rick Steamboat and Jay Youngblood. We want all your fans to see it. You're really going to enjoy it, and here it is.
But are we, Bob? Are we really going to enjoy this all that much? Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood just working out for 3 or 4 minutes, which is effectively what this is. I guess to answer that question of why this even exists, you have to go back to the shoes of somebody who was watching this in February of 1983. And at the time, it was the style to do something like this because just 9 months before this, there was a little movie that came out known as Rocky III, which featured a very similarly homoerotic scene with Apollo Creed and Rocky Balboa training and on the beach, and you got Nutsack flying to and fro in these tiny short shorts, and then finally Rocky beats Apollo in the foot race because Apollo clearly pulled up, not because he pulled a hamstring or anything, but because he was just dogging it to let Rocky get one over on him. So pretty much just like Rocky II, I guess you could say. When he took a dive for Balboa in that one. He wasn't interested in being the champ anymore. So in any event, they're lifting weights. They're running in a field. But it's mostly lifting weights. I mean, you'd think that this was like a Vince McMahon, WBF, Body Stars sort of thing. But I know, they're just preparing for this big cage match against Slaughter and Kernodal. I understand that, but geez, there are limits. I mean, this is giving me flashbacks to that Magnum TA 4-minute thing. At least this has a purpose, because the guys are active, but it also made me wonder, is this why it's not on the WWE Network? Because there's plenty of music video stuff on World Class for 1983, where they put, you know, sometimes good and sometimes bad dubs of other music over it. I don't know what music this actually is, but they lift their arms running away at the end, and it's just truly bizarre. The problem is, you don't want to laugh at Ricky Steamboat because you have too much respect for him as a professional wrestler, so it can't be unintentionally funny. This is like the ultra rare case where Ricky Steamboat is the problem. Because you respect him too much, you're not going to laugh at this, you know, for all the wrong reasons. But hey, you can't argue with the cage match that they had at Final Conflict, which you can seek out on YouTube. There is one video out there that is labeled Final Conflict, but it's most of the show, and then there's like 4 other random matches taken from elsewhere. I don't quite understand. It says bonus content. Like, I'd rather just have the ones from that night in Greensboro. And as we go to the promo area, promo time, it's not really called an event center or anything, it's just like a different area for interviews, definitely not in front of a crowd for shows coming up March 4th in Montrose, Virginia, Hampton, Virginia on March 11th, and Colonial Heights, Virginia, that one is on May 3rd, but the main one in Richmond on March 18th is WRNL Radio Night. Now, that's a sports radio station in the city now, but they got a big trophy there behind Greg Valentine, who we're going to hear from again. It's the second of three promos for Greg Valentine on this show. So if you really like hearing the Hammer talk, this is the program for you. It's a battle royal for that trophy on that show, and it was won by Mike Rotundo, of all people. So Greg Valentine has got a match against Ric Flair, just like at Final Conflict. There's another match scheduled on March 18th in Richmond.
I know a lot of you people are wondering why Greg Valentine wants to wrestle Ric Flair.
Actually, no, Greg, I was not wondering why you wanted to wrestle Ric Flair, because he's the freaking world champion and you've expressed your desire to win that title earlier on this very program. Anyway, go on.
Being United States Heavyweight Champion, I said I was going to be the greatest one of all time. And I've already achieved that goal. But that makes me the number one contender in the country. Just take a look at any magazine, at any 7-Eleven, any convenience store. They'll say, Ric Flair, the champion, number one contender, Greg Valentine. Well, let me tell you one thing, Ric Flair. I've beaten you before. I've taken this title off you in the Richmond Coliseum. Well, I can take that World Heavyweight Championship away from you just as easy. So you better watch out, because I'm coming full steam ahead.
More on Flair and Valentine a little bit later, because for the third Greg Valentine promo, I feel like it's like letters to the Corinthians, like the first letter of Greg Valentine to the Corinthians. I'm not trying to be sacrilegious or anything, I'm just saying Greg Valentine has an awful lot of speaking time on this show. So we go to a six-man group of Oliver Humperdinck, Dick Slater again, and the one-man gang, and Kang. I mean, I know a lot of people make fun of him for the way he looked when he was Akeem, and I like Akeem probably more than most of the general population, but here in his early, you know, one-man gang days, where he's still pretty young, he helpfully is wearing a shirt that just says, one-man gang.
You know, I don't know too much about Bugsy McGraw, but I know one thing, Friday, March 18th, Slater, the gang, and I are going to be stepping in the ring with this Bugsy McGraw, Jimmy Valiant, and Ricky Steamboat. And let me just tell you one thing, Bugsy McGraw. If you think you're going to come here and help Jimmy Valiant hurt me, you got another thing coming.
I know about Bugsy McGraw. Bugsy McGraw is as nuts as Valiant. You know, you guys are going to come with a full bore. I know you'll be loaded, my friends, and everybody knows exactly what I'm talking about. Bugsy McGraw, we're going to get you too, my friend. We're going to clean all your acts up.
The gang doesn't get to speak, which is fine. Humperdinck is actually a little bit more tolerable here than usual, and Slater is Slater. But if the gang, if he's truly a one-man gang, he shouldn't be hanging out with other guys, because he's a one-man gang. He doesn't need to associate with other people, unless I'm approaching it wrong, like I did with Zeus, the human wrecking machine. Is he a human that is a wrecking machine, or is he a machine that is human wrecking? We don't really know. Is the one-man gang a one-man gang, or is he one-man gang? Like, he's a gang, but he's one man. That's the way I always interpreted it, is he's a gang who is one man. Maybe I just have a bad read on it. As they go to the commercial break, for McGeorge Toyota, which still exists in Henrico, Virginia, just northwest of Richmond proper. But the more interesting thing is an ad for the then-fledgling USA Network, pre-WWF. This is before they had any of their programming by some 6 months, when USA was more of a sports network that showed, I don't know if they had the NHL yet at that point, but I know that they had, they showed USFL games in the mid-80s, and they had also college sports. It's very interesting to, because this kind of goes over a lot of the programming that they had.
If you're looking to fill your day with a slightly different kind of entertainment, turn to USA Cable Network. You'll see Kathy Smith teaching aerobics, cooking tips on Women's Day USA, Edie Locke with fashion hits, USA's classic movie, and Sonya with provocative interviews.
Oh, wow.
So watch USA Cable Network and find a world of entertainment every weekday.
USA Network was really great in the 80s and 90s, and they had good shows in the 2000s, ones that I didn't necessarily watch, like Psych and Suits and a few other things. I think Monk was on the USA Network as well, but I mean, that network has declined so precipitously in the last 10 or so years. I mean, having the WWE on there, I don't think it really helps or hurts. I think the declining ratings of WWE has hurt it overall. But, I mean, it's just kind of sad. Like, that's kind of a network of my youth when I would come home and I would watch, like, game shows that would air all afternoon, like Bumper Stompers and, like, other crap. But it was entertainment. And it was kind of like an all-purpose channel. The Up All Night movies on Friday and Saturday. I always watch that sort of stuff. But nowadays, I mean, USA, I'll put it on for Raw, and then I'll immediately regret it later. Now, up next, we have a former NWA World Heavyweight Champion, Jack Briscoe, at his first match in Grease Valentine, as I had mentioned, taking on Red Dog Lane. I looked it up. It's Larry Lane, a longtime veteran of the business who was pretty much winding down at this point. He teamed with Dory Funk in Amarillo. He spent a lot of time there, but some time in Stampede as well. Jack Briscoe, 866 days his reign as the NWA World Heavyweight Champion, when that meant something, which ranks 7th for a cumulative reign in the pre-1991 era. Effectively, I'm not even going to count anything after the association with WCW broke off in 91, when Flair won the title from Sting, and then WCW pretty much kind of, it kind of broke apart when Flair left WCW and they stripped him of the title when he signed with the WWF around that time period, or thereabouts anyway. Just looking at the lists of NWA champions, you get a lot of weird results because it does pull in everybody since 1991, and you don't really think of them too often. I mean, Nick Aldis holds the title if you've been watching NWA Power on a regular basis. Dan Severn famously held the title for a long time in the late 90s and carried it around on WWF television at various points. But cumulative title reigns, it's kind of funny. Dusty Rhodes won the NWA title on 3 occasions, but only held it for a total of 107 days, which pales in comparison with Ron Killings, who held it for 119 days. Now, I know it doesn't match his 24/7 cumulative reign, but still pretty impressive, even though it came after a period of time where I really count it. Now, for this match, we have the esteemed Gerald Briscoe on commentary, and I got news for you. If you only know him from the Attitude Era, and I can't believe I just said I got news for you because that's a total Shawn Michaelsism. By the way, Shawn Michaels famously taught how to shoot by Jerry Briscoe in a hotel room in Montreal the night before the 1997 Survivor Series. But Jerry Briscoe is kind of portrayed as this Oklahoma hick on WWF television when he was one of the Stooges, but he's here on commentary, and no, he's not playing up that angle even when Paul Jones comes out to interrupt him.
Jerry Briscoe, Jack's brother, and Jerry, I tell you, I know it always gives you a little different thrill when your brother's up there in the ring and you're out here watching him in action.
Well, sure does, Bob, but you know, I've watched him for many years, all through college, all through high school, and there's Paul Jones out here.
Paul Jones just walking out, and I don't know what Paul's
up, Jerry Briscoe. If you come out here to learn something, you're watching the wrong man. If you're watching your brother, you ought to watch Dory Funk. He's the champion. You can learn something from champions.
This is where I get confused. I'm like, what year am I in? Am I in some sort of time warp? Is this 1983 or is this 1973? Because you got Dory Funk Jr. having an issue with Jack Briscoe. I mean, what's going on here? And I say 73 because Dory Funk was the NWA champion back in those days with the intention to get the title onto Jack Briscoe. The issue was they were both baby faces, so they needed a transitional champion to come in and win the title off Dory, who would then lose it to Jack within 2 months. And that man was Harley Race, who won the title in May of 73 in Kansas City and then lost it in Houston to Jack Briscoe. Briscoe's two-time champion. He did that thing where he lost it in Japan to Giant Baba and then won it back a week later before dropping it in December of 75 to Terry Funk. So we're going to go back and forth with bickering between Jerry Briscoe and Paul Jones on commentary, insulting each other, which is fine because you got a lot of amateur mat work here. It's purely a Jack Briscoe match. So I'm fine with this, and it's also Paul Jones in the era when he's not completely f***ed out.
You
Speaking of champions, Jack Briscoe is a two-time world champion, two-time NCAA champion, three-time Oklahoma High School State champion, four-time junior high school champion. Only lost two matches in his career. Like, had a record of 150 wins with two losses and about 10 national championships and two world championships. Mr. Jones, if you can't learn a lesson from that, you can't see.
Yeah, and he couldn't buy enough gas to get him from here to Gastonia on it either.
That's right. He's too busy buying orange groves.
Ooh. All right.
Well, listen, I didn't come out here to be insulted or insult you or your brother. I came out here to add a little class to this program.
Anyone else think it's a little weird that Jerry Briscoe is talking about the junior high school championships that his brother won? It's just strange considering that he's a two-time NWA World Heavyweight Champion and has other credentials. It's not like that would make the resume if he wanted to keep it to one page, I don't think. It like reminds me of the time Shaq, before he had won anything with the Lakers, he said, "I've been a winner on every level except for college and pro." It's like, oh, okay, well, that high school, junior high school, I mean, what exactly does that leave? Now, the single leg takedown by Lane fails here, and I'm going to admit that I am not a good play-by-play man for just amateur mat work, so I'm like the least qualified person in the world to call a Jack Briscoe match. He shoots the half? I don't know. It sounds like a good phrase that might be happening here, but Jerry and Bob Cottle, they start talking college wrestling.
Oklahoma State is number one in the country in college wrestling, Jerry. Again, this year, they're undefeated, as a matter of fact. Right, 23-0 Oklahoma State is. And matter of fact, when Jack was a senior at Oklahoma State, their team went 18-0 and shut out nine straight opponents and was number one and had 10 guys in the Big 8 finals, also five, six guys in the national finals, and of course ran away with the team championships. And it's always good to see Oklahoma State back on top. And Jack is still carrying on the tradition here, and he's riding Lane pretty tough right now.
Oh, I think Jack, your brother, I'll be serious for a second here. I think Jack Briscoe's a hell of a wrestler, but you got to admit one thing. He is not the champion right now. Dory Funk Jr. is the champion, so I think your brother ought to look up to Dory.
I imagine he respects Dory Funk, Paul Jones, but you know, you never could defeat him for that Mid-Atlantic Championship yourself, so you had to go out and buy you a boy to do it for you.
What about that, Paul? What about that?
I was watching the match. I didn't hear what he had to say.
I think that was a very good comment from Jerry. Said you never could defeat him yourself, so you had to go out and buy you somebody to do it.
Nice little zinger by Jerry Briscoe on Paul Jones, scoring one Paul has no idea. And he's got no retort for any of that. In case you're wondering, the college wrestling season in 1983, and I know that you are, Brandon, from New Jersey, Oklahoma State and Oklahoma actually co-hosted the NCAA Division I Wrestling Championships that year, but neither one of them actually prevailed. The winner, of course, was Oklahoma. I believe it was their eighth overall championship to that point. Then again, I don't really know much about college wrestling. We get a pin out of nowhere by Jack Briscoe as this match is literally all amateur moves. There's a takedown which Jack bridges out of and just reverses it to get the pinfall. So I guess this is a Jack Briscoe match, and I'm just completely uncomfortable calling it. I complained about a match earlier being a little too kick punchy, so I guess I can't complain about this one not having any kicks or punches in it.
Are you tired of the gotcha of old-fashioned wrenches? Well, now there's Sure-Lok, an incredible new universal wrench with a grip like a vice. Sure-Lok versus all these wrenches makes Sure-Lok a sure winner. From 3/8 to 13/16 or 9mm to 22, Sure-Lok fits them all.
This applies to anybody who doesn't particularly consider themselves very handy with tools and fixing stuff. If you have good tools at hand, like, here's an example. Is years ago, I bought a futon when I moved to Nevada, and I paid probably $100 for it at Walmart. It wasn't particularly great, but it was what it was, and I slept on it for a few months. When I left there, I had no more use for it, and miraculously, I got somebody that I worked with to buy it off me for $75. But they said, look, you have to come over and you have to actually set up the futon for us. Now, I didn't set it up particularly well, so I borrowed my friend Chris's tools, which was pretty much brand new. I would assume that he got it for Christmas, or, you know, he hadn't used it much. It was very high quality stuff, and I was able to build it, you know, tighten everything properly. So this futon was put together much better for these people that I sold it to than what I was experiencing myself. The bottom line is, if you don't have a good toolbox, I just hope that you got a good one for Christmas or whatever holiday you might celebrate. Anywho, back at the ranch here, you have the tag champs again, and we're going to get a promo from them, a more formal one, instead of them just complaining about getting jumped from behind by what they thought was Steamboat and Youngblood, but it was actually Private Jim Nelson. And you really think of Sergeant Slaughter as the lead guy in this team, but in this case, Don Kernodle gets to talk first.
We've been traveling all over the world, meeting and defeating all the great tag teams all over the world. It's one thing, the NWA won't let us defend these belts anymore unless it's against Youngblood and Steamboat. The Youngblood and Steamboat, get ready. You know, everybody out here is chanting Nelson.
Yeah.
Well, we're a little hot about not being able to defend these titles because it takes money out of our pockets. We've told each other we're going to make some examples in this wrestling ring. And it worked for Nelson interfering in that match. Frank Monty, you'd still be on your back and out of it. Nelson, you're cruising for a bruising. If you want to get involved in this, you step in that ring face to face and bring that hat along with you, because I'm sick and tired of you and everybody else and anybody that wants to step in that ring with us. Until that big, big match we have with Steamboat and Youngblood, be ready to bleed, be ready to sweat, and be ready to get hurt.
He's cruising for bruising.
First thing I think of when I hear that phrase, cruising for a bruising, is that Pink Floyd song. I don't remember which one it is, but it's one of the ones with a lot of talking in the background, which I know only nails it down to about 78 Pink Floyd songs. But I was like, what is the origin of that phrase? I know I wonder that a lot with things that just get said, but cruising for a bruising actually originated in Black English, so African-American English. And 1940s usage of cruising is meaning strolling. So cruising for a bruising means looking for trouble, courting violence, as you know, especially while riding about in a car. So I guess, you know, cruising, I guess, in the Al Pacino, Huey Lewis, Gwyneth Paltrow sense of the term, I suppose. I don't know. And Paul Jones is out there with the Mid-Atlantic title, which is the title that Dory Funk Jr. has at this point that he was referring to earlier. Dory is actually booking Jim Crockett Promotions at this point, if I'm not mistaken. And once again, when you're talking about Dory Funk Jr. holding a title, I'm just like, oh, all right, what the hell year is this?
Jack Briscoe wants Dory spelled right here. Well, let me tell you something. Dory and I saw Jack the other day shopping for a new Volkswagen. Briscoe, your goal is not high enough. You need to get a bigger dream. You want a Volkswagen? Can you imagine somebody wanting a Volkswagen just trying to get this spelled here? No way, Briscoe. Think a little bigger. Set your goals higher.
I don't know why Paul Jones has such a problem with Volkswagens. I mean, it's not like they were known for unreliability or anything in the 80s, to my knowledge, being a German car. But think bigger, the fact that he's using that phrase is kind of ironic, considering that one of the all-time great advertising campaigns in history was Volkswagen's Think Small campaign in the early 60s.
This year, just about everyone's coming out with a brand new small car. So this year, just about everyone will be telling you about this great new idea. To think it is a great idea. We at Volkswagen have been working on it for 21 years.
They were not selling the Beetle or the Punch Buggy in 1983 model year, at least in the United States. That had stopped in 79, and then they brought it back in the late 90s, I think it was. Because I remember actually riding in one. I knew somebody who had one of them, but I cannot remember for the life of me who it was. Anyway, if you want to buy a 1983 Volkswagen, there are some for sale on autotrader.com, where in the high teens, like $18,000, $19,000, you can buy yourself a Volkswagen Vanagon, which basically looks like one of those vans that you can use to go out and take on the Libyans from Back to the Future. I feel like that would be a good fighting vehicle and good for wrestlers on the road. It's just kind of hard to imagine Jack and Jerry Briscoe riding around one of those. But hey, you know, whatever. They got to have plenty of room for the boys. So Oliver Humperdinck is back again with the one-man gang. Why do they keep having promos with the same people on this show? Doesn't this promotion have a pretty deep roster, especially in 1983? They got words for Bugsy McGraw, and I'm only playing it because I've made up my mind that this is the least annoying version of Oliver Humperdinck.
Conspicuous by his absence, you know, Jimmy Valiant's running around here saying he wants a part of me, he wants a part of the one-man gang, he wants a part of Dickie Slater, he wants a part of Greg Valentine. Well, Jimmy Valiant, here we are. All you have to do is come on down and get it. Now, he's got this Bugsy person with him, too. Bugsy McGraw, I think, is his name. Let this be a warning to Bugsy McGraw, Andre the Giant, and anybody else that wants to try the big man. We're going to be ready for you.
And we'll be back right after this.
See, that wasn't so bad, I guess. I mean, maybe if I do a Florida show, I could even grow to love Oliver Humperdinck. Nah, I don't think that's going to happen. As we go to the commercial break with supplemental insurance from Physicians Mutual, nothing interesting there. One of those old CD music sort of things that the drifters get old music. A PSA for the Episcopal Church, which was mildly interesting, but not as fun as this ad featuring B.J. Thomas for the television show Hee Haw.
Hello, I'm B.J. Thomas, and believe me, there's more than raindrops falling on my head these days. Some of the corniest jokes I've ever heard have been falling all around me this week, because I'm visiting with the Shameless Comics on the Hee Haw show. But you know those pretty girls make up for the corny guys. Not to mention the pretty music. So join me on the Hee Haw show this week. See for yourself.
Hee Haw, Saturdays at 7, here on WTBR TV6.
Hee Haw went off the air in 1992. I do remember watching it in the late 80s. It was, I think, syndicated out to one of the stations in the Boston area. And I had absolutely no idea what the hell was going on or why any of it was funny. Now, I'd have a greater appreciation for it now, but as a 9-year-old growing up in the greater Boston area, Hee Haw, I didn't know what the hell was going on. And speaking of things that I don't know, I have no clue who this interviewer is that's not Bob Caudle conducting our next segment, which is finally the joint interview of Greg Valentine and Ric Flair leading up to the final conflict show in Greensboro on March the 12th. I should mention, because I've said final conflict numerous times, that they don't say final conflict, at least on this TV. That might be something that was branded a little bit later, which I'm totally cool with. Like, when I did ECW shows a while ago, I don't do a whole lot of them because they're very, very hard to take notes for because everything moves too damn fast. When they would do those ECW arena shows and they would name them, like in May of 98, the show was This Ain't Seinfeld. I love stuff like that. Hell, I love it. The old Bruce Springsteen concerts from the 70s and 80s that have like titles attached to them. Like, May 1978, Boston, the Million Dollar Sound Show. It's like, oh, that actually gives a sort of, you know, vibe to what was going on. So anyway, Valentine and Flair, they're standing together, but yet they're opponents for this upcoming match. And Greg Valentine, clearly a heel. I mean, you've gathered that from all the time he has been on this program up to this point. Now, Ric Flair, as the traveling NWA champion in 1983, even though just like Andre's traveling around to the various territories, Flair as NWA champion isn't going to be doing that. By the time 1986 rolls around, that's a thing of the past, and he's exclusive to Jim Crockett Promotions. But here, when you're the champion, you've got to go to various places, and you have to be a babyface or heel, usually a heel because you're going to go in and take on the local hero and try to draw the house that way. But in the local territory, Flair was something of a babyface. Of course, he's a super babyface by the time Starrcade 83 rolls around, and it's just completely unquestioned. So Ric Flair promo styles change depending on, you know, what situation he's in. He's almost like an amoeba. In this case, he's kind of like what old veteran of the Pro Wrestling Only Feed Parv used to say, where he's Minnesota Rick, where he's like the down-home, I don't want to say aw shucks, but here he's just incredibly calm.
It's kind of a complicated item we're talking about today. We're talking about the World Heavyweight Championship. We're talking about the U.S. Heavyweight Championship. We're talking about two men that have been friends over the years, two men that have been partners, two men that have accomplished just about everything there is to accomplish in professional wrestling. But business is business. And although I have all the respect in the world for Greg Valentine, he's probably recognized as the greatest U.S. champion of all time. He's held the title, and he's defeated every top contender that's come his way. Likewise, I won the World Heavyweight Championship, and I've defeated every top contender that's come my way. Now Greg Valentine is ranked at number one. Number one in line for a shot at the World Heavyweight Championship. And the people out there are calling, they're clamoring, they're knocking at the door, the promoters, they want the match. So Valentine and I are out here, aware of what's about to happen in the future, and aware of the fact that we're going to have to get in that ring, and we're going to have to decide between the two of us just who the better man is. Greg, I have a lot of respect for you. You know that. We've been round and round. We've done just about all there is to do in professional wrestling. So when you and I get in that ring, Greg, I want you to know it'll be for the World Heavyweight Championship, and may the best man win.
There's no big woo, there's no style in a profile, and there's none of the histrionics that you get from Ric Flair later on. And if I do have one critique of the Nature Boy in the years after this point, I would say sometimes he maybe didn't bring this out enough. Of course, he wasn't a babyface as often as I would have liked until you get to that point around 1996-97 where it just becomes impossible to boo him, and he becomes sort of the legendary figure babyface going forward. So they actually shake hands in the middle of this before Valentine, who clearly has had way too much speaking time on this show. It's not a critique of Valentine himself. I respect him as a professional wrestler. But at this point, it's starting to get to the point where it's like Bill Clinton at the 88 Democratic Convention, where he gives one of those Bill Clinton speeches where he goes on, and the crowd is like groaning because they just want him to formally nominate Mike Dukakis and to shut the hell up. And he gets to the point where in the speech where he says, and in conclusion, and the crowd pops wildly. Oh, they just go bananas for it. But anyway, Valentine, he's got a shot at the world title. And he's, I guess, as excited as a Greg Valentine will get.
Well, thank you, Rick. You know, I have a lot of respect and admiration more than anybody else in professional wrestling for Ric Flair. I've been his partner. We've been world tag team champions together. He just said a mouthful when he said that I was the greatest United States champion of all time because he was once United States champion. But I want to say one thing. I think Ric Flair has achieved goals beyond expectation. He is Harley Race is the world champion. Terry Funk has been a world champion. Dory Funk Jr., Jack Briscoe. I think Ric Flair has been a better world champion than all four of those champions put together. But if it came right down to it, you know, the ultimate goal of every professional wrestler is to become a world champion. I want to be the world champion. I don't want to wrestle Ric Flair, my friend, but if I had to, I would wrestle Ric Flair, and I would use everything possible to try and win and take that belt that Ric Flair's got around his waist right now. That's the way it is, and the way it must be.
What excitement from Greg Valentine having an opportunity at the World Heavyweight Championship. I'm taping this before Christmas, and all I could think is that Greg Valentine as a child on Christmas. For some reason, I just can't imagine that. I just always imagine him, Valentine, as just him, like what he is, like what you saw of him on TV in the 1980s, like whether he be like right now where he's aged 60 or 70, however old he is, or as like a six-year-old child who wants a Red Ryder BB gun or whatever the hell it is that he would have wanted. You got to think about it from a kayfabe perspective. Being the NWA champ is pretty hard because you go to all these places and usually you're going to be in the heel locker room, but a lot of the time, sometimes you might end up in the babyface locker room as well. I think, you know, Ted DiBiase should have been the NWA champion at some point just because of his networking skill that I talked about in one of the previous episodes. I think he would have been really good at it, doing it in that era. It's just that he was born probably about 5 to 10 years too late. So we get more event-specific promos, the ones from early March, from Hampton, Colonial Heights, Richmond, all that sort of stuff. And we get the six-man tag coming up, which is the unlikely team of Jimmy Valiant, Bugsy McGraw, and Ricky Steamboat. And just picturing Steamboat with those two guys, just like hanging out, like
Here's this family man, and then you got Valiant and Bugsy McGraw. Like, Bugsy, who's hanging out with children, very uncomfortably, I might add, on World Class Championship Wrestling in 1982. Jimmy Valiant, we all know that he's insane. And I'm going to tell you, you're not going to believe, like I said, what was happening with Jimmy Valiant around this time.
Well, everybody knows for the past several months now what's been coming down between the House of Humperdinck and Mr. Jimmy Valiant. Everybody that he's been throwing up in front of Jimmy Valiant, Jimmy Valiant's been getting rid of. But now there's a six-man tag team combination. They've been ganging up on this particular individual, cutting his hair. One-man gang, Humperdinck and Dick Slater. Myself, Jimmy the Boogie Woogie Man Valiant, and Mr. Bugsy McGraw in a six-man combination. Well, let him tell you how it is.
You got that right, Ricky. People, brothers, sisters, I got the craziest dude on the street. Bugsy. I mean, Bugsy. Crazy Bugsy. Humperdinck. One-man gang. Slater, you cut my hair. But that's war. You're marked men. Pound for pound, this is the toughest dude I know, Ricky Steamboat. And I got Ricky and my brother, Bugsy, and we're coming at you. Look out.
They're cutting Jimmy Valiant's hair? I can't believe it. I'm completely shocked by all of this. I can't believe that that's happening. But this made me wonder, is the reason for this not being on the WWE Network, the fact that they're playing the music during Jimmy Valiant's promo and it's just really hard to edit one out or the other? I mean, I guess you could just cut this thing if you wanted to throw it on the network, but you'd be missing out on something very, very hilarious, which is the three of these guys together. His Steamboat starts out with the promo, and he's holding the microphone because they don't have the guy conducting the interview and holding out the microphone. So Steamboat is saying his piece, and then Jimmy Valiant comes marching in, the music starts playing, and Steamboat is holding the microphone like an interviewer, and he's doing everything he can not to laugh. He's stone-faced the entire time. It's a good job by Ricky Steamboat. Shows me that he could have been an actor if things had gone a little bit differently. On the other side, we got Dick Slater, the one-man gang, and Oliver Humperdinck. I don't want to play this interview again because we've heard enough from these guys already. I mean, we're getting three promos from every single person that's on this show. But if I don't play it, I'm not going to get the great tagline of all taglines.
Well, bring it on, my friend. You think we're stupid? You think we signed contracts thinking we're going to get in the ring and get our brains beat in? No. We're coming loaded for bear. 450 pounds, and Humperdinck, when he puts on a pair of tights, is a lethal weapon, my friend. And Bugsy McGraw, you may be a street brother, but I don't care, because you got to do a lot to beat me down and a lot to beat Humperdinck down. And in Richmond, we're going to see just how brave you gentlemen are, because we are not stupid, and we are going to take care of business in the way we know how.
Nobody accused you of being stupid, Dick Slater. I mean, you managed to get yourself into a TV title position. I mean, who knows how long that's going to be, but we are not stupid. When you get the heels together yelling that, there's something very, very funny. And One Man Gang doesn't get to say anything, so he just kind of yells that thing at the end like he's Yokozuna on last week's show when Mean Gene Okerlund is walking through the promo because Fuji can't really talk. So now we got Mike Rotundo back again, and he had the TV title before he lost it to Dick Slater. And he's confronting Gary Hart about all of this, and well, this is very Mike Rotundo.
You don't need to be here. You already had your chance in Columbia, South Carolina, where you were, and you helped that man steal the belt. I don't want you interfering in my chance to win that TV championship back, so I don't think you should be here.
Just let me say, why don't you get in the ring with my associate and see how great you really are? Why don't we just get it on right now? My associate's problem.
I'm fine with that, but I don't want you interfering.
Geez, show a little fire there, Mike. I mean, you lost the title, you're PO'd about it, but you have all the charisma and anger of a tax agent going in there. So, I guess it's a chilling vision of things to come. This is now the match, Mike Rotundo against Dick Slater for the TV title. Presumably, I would assume that it's not non-title, as Rotundo gets attacked on the apron because Slater is already in the ring. He gets tossed back to the outside. So Gary Hart is on commentary for this one. And Gary was in world class up to the end of 1982. He was booking I don't want to say they were sad sack for much of 1982, because the WorldCast podcast actually made 82 world class watchable for me. by making heroes out of the likes of Al Madrill and just kind of get you through the year, get you to when the Freebirds show up in October. And October, oh wow, that's real bad accent coming out. But anyway, Gary, he walks out on them after Star Wars 82, which you think, okay, well, that's maybe not the best time for him to leave because the territory is about to catch fire. Well, he had a dispute with Fritz over money, which apparently they got over it years later because Gary Hart would be back in World Class in due time. But 1983 World Class with Gary Hart, if he had stuck around, would be kind of interesting. But I don't think he was entirely needed because that territory was hot enough that they did not need a manager like him around. So the Freebirds did not need any managers because you could get Michael Hayes there to do all the talking. And so you get a roll up by Rotundo for two, you get a back and forth small package that also gets two. And Gary Hart on commentary, I never really make up my mind. A lot of times I do enjoy him. I think he has a very smooth, well, I don't want to say a smooth voice, but I think he has a good manager's voice. Sometimes, though, he might not be annoying enough, like in that Jimmy Hart sort of vein. But he does have kind of a message that goes, I think, beyond the world of professional wrestling.
Small package, got him hooked good. The referee won't count. Prejudice is a bad thing, no matter where you find it in the world, most of all in the wrestling ring. That referee is prejudiced.
He actually was kind of right. The referee was out of position, but I wouldn't chalk that up to say prejudice, but it is a good message. You know, the prejudice exists and it really shouldn't. So we get a head scissor by Mike Rotundo as Gary Hart tells us that the great Kabuki will be coming in. Speaking of guys from 1982 World Class, they had to clear it with immigration or so the story went. 2 weeks before this on the TV that like, oh, I couldn't get Kabuki in. So I'd like to know the nature of those negotiations with Gary Hart and the immigration authorities. Back in 82, I think that sort of thing was a little bit more, a little bit more loose with the rules, especially now since it's such a hot button issue as Slater gets a two count with a back elbow. But then he flips the script, especially for those of us who know Mike Rotundo as IRS, an abdominal stretch on Mike Rotundo. I mean, talk about a reversal of fortune, but Rotundo knows how to get out of the move. Nobody knows the abdominal stretch quite like Mike Rotundo, especially when you're just grabbing the top rope for leverage. He hip tosses out of it, and then he fires up and gets the airplane spin. I'm going to say Mike Rotundo has one of the better airplane spins. Of course, that might be because he's one of the only guys with an airplane spin. And he puts it into a Death Valley driver because that is what it is. I mean, he spins the guy around and then he slams the guy in basically a Death Valley driver. Well, we get a foot on the ropes on the pin attempt. But then Dick Slater, he counters with a roll up. The kind of thing where you grab both, scoop both legs, and you would ordinarily put both feet on the ropes in the corner. The old Ric Flair finish. But he doesn't even put feet on the ropes, and Rotunda just gets pinned. 1, 2, 3. So I'm like, okay, that's a little strange. Like, Rotunda just kind of loses clean in this one. And Gary Hart, he's got a saying for all of this, and he cleans it up a little from what the way I usually hear it.
Like they say in Chicago, money talks and suckers walk. That sucker better walk.
It takes me to the movie Spinal Tap, which comes out a couple of years after this. But, I mean, the saying had been around for a long time. You got Fran Drescher, who's like the record executive, talking to Ian Faith, who's like the manager of Spinal Tap. And she says the saying that is the way you usually hear it.
Money talks and bullshit walks.
The best part of that is how Ian like furrows his brow like he's actually never heard that phrase before. It's so damn funny. I love that movie so much. But what an odd finish this was, where the babyface challenges, he gets wronged, he gets the title taken away previously, and we have the rematch, and all of a sudden Dick Slater ends up winning cleanly here. But I guess Rotundo will get his because he won that battle royal in that one show where they were giving away the trophy. But, you know, I guess this is just, it is what it is. It was that week in 1983 that Thriller reached number one, where it stayed for 37 weeks, which is just incredible how Americans came together and decided that we agreed that we loved Michael Jackson. We don't agree on anything these days, whether it be an artist. Like, anybody who hosts the Oscars faces some sort of weird criticism out of it. It's like a totally thankless job. But, yeah, Michael Jackson, of course, turned out to be a total weirdo. And speaking of which, we got Jimmy Valiant and Bugsy McGraw, a duo that I love so much because Jimmy Valiant is the low-key guy of these two. I talked about Bugsy on World Class and how he would kind of dress up in a clownish outfit and hang out with the children in the crowd, which in 1982, I guess, was sort of normal. The moral panics hadn't quite set in, but from 2019 eyes, it looks particularly, I don't know, egregious, I guess, is the word for it. Now, last week, and you're not going to believe, yeah, they cut Jimmy Valiant's hair. I swear to God, that's like a rite of passage for everybody. It's like facing Jerry Lawler in Memphis. Cutting Jimmy Valiant's hair is something that all good wrestlers should do on their way up, or, you know, whether they've reached the peak of the profession. But they play the video of it. What the studio audience, of course, is going crazy, like as if Jimmy Valiant is being actually stabbed with the scissors rather than having his hair cut.
Slater go at Humperdinck, grabs Valiant and holds him. Here comes Ray Valentine out, a one-man gang, and Valentine and Slater now are holding. They're holding Valiant and cutting his hair, and here is someone else now into the ruckus. We had a wild mayhem right here.
I might be the only person on the planet who believes that there actually weren't enough Jimmy Valiant hair angles, because I friggin' love every single one of them that comes along. I mean, this from the studio audience to Jimmy Valiant's reaction to, like, very sensible, I might add. His solution to this problem is just wear a hat for a while. Makes a lot of sense when you really think about it. But now, they are quite fired up based on what happened, both him and Bugsy. And we get the fired up promo that I swear could have come out of the mouth of John Belushi as Bluto in Animal House.
Slater, you're a marked man. Valentine, you're marked. Humperdinck and One Man Gang, listen at me. Slater, you got that TV title. It don't belong to you. It belongs to the people. When I beat Ivan Koloff, I gave it to the people. That's the people's belt. Valentine, I'm going to get you where it hurts you. You say you're the greatest champion of all time. Well, you're not. And I'm gonna take that belt. One more thing, Mr. One Man Gang. You had the scissors. You cut my hair, and I'm gonna cut your hair. You're gonna be completely bald. And now, Mr. Humperdinck, I want one match with you. And no, Loser Leave Town. He's challenging me. I'm challenging you, Loser Leave Town. This is my street brother. This is my street brother. We grew up together. We grew up together. We're the same gang. The same.
Stand together.
Straight brother.
Yeah. What we really got here, brother, just a few words about this. What we got at this is the word is freedom. You understand? Freedom. And when freedom comes so easy, and we take it for granted, brother, you understand? Taking freedom for granted, we sometimes lose sight of the fact that we got to fight for it. We got to stand up and say who we are and what we are. And I'm standing right by my man, the Boogie Woogie Man, and we're going to get down. It's going to be called declared war.
I really was on the edge of my seat wondering if Jimmy Valiant was going to say, Slater, dead. Humperdinck, dead. They talk about the one-man gang cutting his hair, because he was the one who actually had the scissors. He also cut the hair of Elegante in 1991 WCW, so it wouldn't be the last time that he would pull off something like that. And the gang did lose a hair match, but it would be in 1985 World Class. Mike Rotundo attempts to follow that, which is just absolutely hilarious. Like, Who's the last guy in wrestling history you would want to follow a Jimmy Valiant and Bugsy McGraw co-promo? Nah, Mike Rotundo, yeah, that's really not going to work. Ricky Steamboat becomes the first person on this show to actually mention the Final Conflict show, or what it would become to be known as, from March 12th. And with it being for the tag titles and in a cage, Steamboat adds just one more little stipulation to it.
Everybody saw what kind of training that we're doing right now. We're real serious about this. We got that one condition that they put upon us. If we don't win this match, this tag team is dissolved. We've been working out real hard in training and talking about working out. This man over here has been showing us how to work out with the Cobra Clutch. And Slaughter, I'm ready. I just wanted to prove to you and Don Canole that I'm not scared of you. I've never been scared of you, and I'm coming for you. You want this hat? Come on and get it. I'll tell you what, these guys are ready, and they're going to take those belts.
Cobra Clutch!
You're going to find out why I'm the Sergeant Slaughter, and you're the private.
Well, I mean, I guess the stipulation had been in place, but I don't think I had brought it up. But you know, I'm glad that the show got mentioned, because it doesn't feel like they're making enough of a big deal out of it. But maybe that's just me projecting backwards, given that the show would get this legendary aura attached to it. Due in part to Jim Nelson, the future Boris Zukov, actually having the footage of it and making it publicly available. So I thank him, and you know what? I'm going to take it easy on Boris Zukov from now on, because while he wasn't the greatest shakes in the ring, I have to admit, I enjoy his really low-rent Sergeant Slaughter imitation in early 80s Mid-Atlantic. And that's it for Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling for February 26, 1983. Now, another podcast this week on the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Marotta and Michael Quinn, they got their holiday special, and they're reviewing a Hulk Hogan movie, and it would be Suburban Commando, which I'll admit, I've never actually seen that movie. I probably should. I think it's bad that I haven't. I actually voted for them to review Mr. Nanny. I think that would have made for some better material. Plus, it's got Sherman Helmsley in it. I mean, how the hell can you turn down something like that? Anyway, on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Brian Malonis, Brian Fury is out delivering for UPS as part of his 3 weeks of hell program during the Christmas season. It is their special Festivus episode, which, considering that the name of the show comes from a Seinfeld-related thing, I enjoy this Festivus episode every year, even though one of the calls in was like a 5-minute filibuster, and I wasn't exactly sure where it was going. But be sure to listen. I loved Brian Malonis's impassioned defense of Ring of Honor from all these charges of Joey Mercury that was happening on Twitter. Just, you know, while even if there is a grain of truth to what he might be saying, could we not just like blindly believe what this guy is saying when, as Brian pointed out, he does have a history of burning bridges in places that he's been? So again, you might want to weigh all the things, you know, as part of a greater context. And, of course, check out the Sportscasters with my good pal Steve Bennett, an extensive catalog out there. I don't know if he'll have the episode dropping before this episode drops, given that it's the holiday and all of that. A lot of podcasts tend to avoid Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. I actually thought, well, maybe I should just drop this on Christmas, but people want to listen to podcasts and get away from their family, but I don't think they can really get away with it. It's not like I can like disappear upstairs and listen to something. Maybe a shorter podcast. I don't think I get away with listening to a 4-hour whatever. Now, I can't do any of my famous end of the show segments because YouTube Comment Theater, there's like one YouTube comment, and I don't even remember what it was. It wasn't really worth a damn, quite frankly. Vinny Vegas Corner I can't do because I don't have the point spreads for next week as I'm taping this. But I did go 2-0-1 last week, which brings my record for the season to 25-21-2. I emerged victorious in my NFL wins pool, by the way, which I damn well should have considering I had New England, Minnesota, Green Bay, Baltimore, and San Francisco as 5 of my 6 teams, and they have all won at least 10 games, and all of them but Minnesota have won more than 10 games. Next week's show for episode 149, I'm undecided. I'm just going to let, you know, whatever strikes my fancy on YouTube, so it'll be kind of a wild card week. But for episode 150, 2 weeks from now, it's going to be one that I've targeted for a very long time, and it's WWF's TNT from May 3rd, 1985, which would be the episode where all the jobbers appeared as guests. There are 9 different enhancement guys: Rusty Brooks, Pete Doherty, Jose Luis Rivera, Jim Powers, Paul Roma, Mario Mancini, Steve Lombardi, and so many more. Did I already say Rusty Brooks? Because Rusty Brooks is one of the highlights of that show. So I've been looking forward to that, and it should be a lot of fun to cover. And while I think of this, please give a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts for Greetings from Allentown. There's 56 reviews on there. I'd like to get it to 60, which would mean 4 additional 5-star reviews. You know what that does? It provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this podcast. And happy Boxing Day to all of you who are listening to this on the first day of release and are not in the United States. Not entirely sure what Boxing Day is. It was explained to me years ago, oh, it's the day they clean up the boxes from Christmas. Like, no, I don't think that's it. I believe it has something to do with the old days of servants. This would be their holiday because they had to actually work on Christmas for the families. I think it was. This is probably something where I should stop and look it up, but I'm not going to do that. So I am out of here. Thank you so much for listening, and tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
We are not stupid.